from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, impeachment or a Soviet-style kangaroo court, test scores get worse, organ harvesting in China, and a look at perseverance. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and homeschool dad. This week, the Democrat-led House announced their rules for impeachment proceedings, and it's not exactly fair to House Republicans, or to the president for that matter. Joining Family Research Council President Tony Perkins to talk about it is Louisiana Congressman and House Minority Whip Steve Scalise.
Steve, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, great to be back with you.
Great job on the House floor today. I want to bring the point out. You had a poster on the floor, and the point of your comments was that this is Soviet-style investigations that are taking place. These are the kind of things you would see in the Soviet Union, not in the United States, when it comes to how the Democrats are handling this investigation of the president.
It really is, Tony. And when you think about it, you know, there's been other impeachments. I mean, Andrew Johnson, nobody saw those, of course. But then the Clinton and the Nixon impeachments, they were televised live. Both sides had the same set of rules. It was fair rules. Republicans and Democrats could both call witnesses. The president was able to have legal counsel in the room to question. That's not the case today. And in fact, we've seen what's going on in Adam Schiff's little secret chamber where he's hiding, literally having hearings in secret, not letting other members of Congress in, not even yesterday or earlier this week. He wouldn't even let certain Republican questions be answered by the witness. That is Soviet style justice. And then in the resolution today, it actually gives the chairman, a Democrat, the authority to deny witnesses the Republicans call. It actually allows the chairman not only to veto Republican witnesses, but it allows the chairman to kick the president's legal counsel out of the room if he so chooses. Is that fairness? Would they subject themselves to those kind of rules if they were falsely accused of a crime? And I think that's really where the American people look and say, hold on a second. I don't mind looking into something maybe, but to deny due process, to deny basic fairness, it begs the question, what are they hiding? And that really gets to the heart of what people like Jim Jordan and others in that room have been saying, is what they're hearing in the room is not anything that's high crimes or misdemeanors. It's a lot of innuendo. And in many cases, by people who just don't like the president, which is why you have elections. But then they leak selective things out to the press to make it look so much worse. And then you don't know because the press isn't allowed in the room.
Well, could it be, Steve, that they're not really concerned about the procedures being fair because they know that the Senate is going to reject it? And so this is more about political theater. It's about being able to put their spin on it. It's about them to be able to work the narrative they want that is the most politically damaging, or at least they think it is, of the president.
It is. And, you know, that's been their intention from the beginning, from the day the president was sworn in. They said they wanted to impeach him before he was even president of the United States. So, you know, Tony, you've been pointing this out, but others can see that this isn't about violations of crimes, which, by the way, is what the founders warned against. I mean, Alexander Hamilton wrote very specifically in Federalist Paper Number 65. He was concerned that the power of impeachment could one day be abused for political purposes as opposed to for criminal acts. And unfortunately, today on the House floor, Alexander Hamilton's concerns were sought and followed through by the Democrats, who did, in fact, just that, not because they listed any crimes. They haven't. It's the hope of crimes. That was what the Mueller investigation was about for almost 2 years. You saw all of that circus, and it yielded not one single charge. And instead of giving up, they just keep going and trying to find somebody that can make a claim. They investigate the claim. They see nothing there, and they go on to something else. We have an election next year, Tony. The people of this country are the ones who should decide who's the president, not Nancy Pelosi, not Adam Schiff in some secret room in the basement of the Capitol.
Now, let me address an issue of, well, this is partisan. Republicans are going to protect the president because he is a Republican. Now, Steve, you and I have known each other for, 25 years. We served in the Louisiana House together. I've got many, many friends in Congress, principled men and women, who I know that if this president, whether he was Republican or Democrat, had done something to violate the Constitution or high crimes and misdemeanors, would not stand on a party line, but would pursue what was right and true. It's very telling to me that not a single Republican who voted in favor of impeachment or moving forward, I should say, with this process.
Right. It was significant. You know, and even Speaker Pelosi months ago said the only way you do something as divisive as impeachment is if it's bipartisan. And the only bipartisan vote today was against impeachment. Every single Republican voted against it. And we had a number of Democrats that voted against it because even they couldn't stand the Soviet-style process. So, you know, if you want to look at why they're still moving forward, I think we know how politically motivated it is. They're just trying to hurt the president's chances of getting reelected for all the reasons that we talked about. As you mentioned, most pro-life president we've ever had. The economy, we have the hottest economy in the world right now. People are seeing higher wages. This is what we should be celebrating and doing more of. Right. And instead, they're trying to take the president away from continuing this kind of successful conservative agenda. Right. And look, there are Republicans, we've all seen them, who have been critical of the president in different ways. So it's not like everybody is just falling in line because he's a Republican. You know, even some of those Republicans who have been critical of certain things the president's done said this isn't right. This is not due process, not fair, and they haven't laid out a case.
Steve, before we run out of time, I want to shift because I'm concerned with this political theater, that it's going to be a distraction, and it's dangerous if we miss what's happening internationally. Like this, what some are predicting may be a new Arab Spring. We see violence in Iraq. We see Lebanon, violence there, Egypt. Is there a concern that this political theater could be a distraction?
I hope it's not, but, you know, you've seen it. I mean, there is an uprising that is similar to the Arab Spring in 2011 in a number of countries. Lebanon's government is about to fall if it hasn't already. We're seeing in Iraq and other countries these young people that are rising up against corrupt governments, and that's what it's about. It's about corruption in government that people are just fed up with, and that's encouraging. You know, and at the same time, things like, for example, the Intelligence Committee, where a lot of these hearings should be going on what's happening around the world, including the things that led up to al-Baghdadi's capture. Adam Schiff hasn't had those kind of hearings because he's been so focused on impeachment in his committee, which, by the way, his committee is not supposed to be the lead committee on impeachment. It's supposed to be judiciary. But I think Pelosi doesn't have any confidence in Jerry Nadler, who runs the committee. That's her pick. But she doesn't have confidence in him, so she's shifted it all over to Schiff's committee on intelligence, and so they're not getting those intelligence briefings. Republican or Democrat members who should be involved in at least knowing some of the hot spots around the world and what we're doing about it.
Yeah, extremely important given what happened in the last Arab Spring, Syria, Libya, those countries. We need to keep our eye on that. Steve Scalise, thanks so much for joining us. Great to talk with you, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Always great to be with you, Tony. Thanks.
You can find out more about Steve Scalise when you visit TonyPerkins.com. While you're there, you can also find out how you can receive Tony's daily update. It's a daily email with the top stories concerning faith, family, and freedom. Again, that's TonyPerkins.com.
Several radical abortion laws throughout the country are challenging the sanctity of life. The Family Research Council wants to remind Congress that babies should be welcomed with a warm hat, not potential danger. Our goal is to send 90,000 hats to U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and support has allowed us to purchase over 45,000 of those baby hats. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Earlier this week, it was reported that test scores have continued to decline. Joining FRC President Tony Perkins to discuss the concerning trend is the former Secretary of Education, Dr. Bill Bennett.
I want to talk about this as the former Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan. When you look at the test scores, especially math and reading, we're seeing a decline. We're not moving up. We're moving backwards. What's going on?
I'm, I'm so glad you brought that up. This is the release, the new release of the NAEP, what we call the NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. This is one thing the Department of Education does that's worthwhile. It's a national assessment of how much our students are learning. It's done across the nation, sample groups from each state. This was something I supported and actually strengthened when I was at the department as secretary. And you're exactly right. We're going backwards. 10 years, even 20 years, our math scores are steady, a little off, and our reading scores are down. Now, I was I was asked about impeachment this morning. I'll be asked about it again. I commented on that. I said, it's, very serious matter. The fires in California are serious. But for the long run, the failure of our students to be able to think, to read, to count, is potentially catastrophic if you think about what China's up to. And let me just tell you one, this tells you the world in which we live, Tony. I know you probably can't be shocked anymore by stuff, but there was one note in the report that said one bright light is that this gap between white students and black students has been closed somewhat in these results. You know how it was closed?
Yeah,
the
it's
white
not...
students declined.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
And that's a reason to celebrate. Now, I will say that for the left, that's a reason to celebrate. But that was one of the concerning things in this report is that those students that could be helped the most through the uplifting power of education are actually the ones that are seeing the greatest declines.
That's correct. Yeah, the kids who need it the most, the kids for whom school is the most important. You know, the top 10% are still doing fine. You know, you grow up in a family that values education. You do homework with the kids. You encourage them to read. You stimulate them intellectually. You cut off the television. You give them a good pedigree. They're going to succeed. But kids who need it the most, where maybe the home life isn't so good, maybe there's not encouragement, where school can be the difference. H.G. Wells said, life is a race between education and catastrophe. Where school can be the difference between catastrophe and success, those schools are failing the most. And that's not America. That's not what we're supposed to be. And it just infuriates me. And the last thing I'll say, apart from the scores, Tony, in reading and math, and I'm so glad you brought this up, we do worse in American history than we do in even those two. It's our worst subject. Our students do not know who they are in terms of being Americans.
You can find out more about Dr. Bill Bennett when you visit tonyperkins.com. Coming up, Tony talks with investigative journalist Ethan Gutman about China's disturbing involvement in organ harvesting. We'll be back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this.
We live in a time of great political division, and this divisiveness can be incredibly discouraging. It makes it very tempting for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. But Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, including how they engage in politics. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. Visit frc.org/engage to learn more.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. This past summer, an international human rights charity revealed that forced organ donations of religious minorities in China has been occurring for quite some time. Joining Tony to talk about this important practice is investigative journalist Ethan Gutman.
Ethan, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hello from foggy London town.
Well, thank you for staying up late and joining us. This is a problem that the world is now beginning to become aware of. How long has China been engaged in what we believe to be forced organ harvesting?
We've known something about it since 2006, and our knowledge has only increased with every passing year. But in fact, the first live organ harvest, as far as I can tell, based on my research, started in about 1995, 1994. in Xinjiang, in northwest China, the home of the Uyghurs. So in execution grounds, they first started shooting people in a non-lethal manner and then pulling out their organs because they take much better than the new host. It's a bit like cutting flowers under running water or something. And after that, in 1997, a handful of political prisoners, Uyghurs, were harvested on behalf of some high-ranking cadres. And so that is the beginning. And then it picks up real steam when Falun Gong comes online. That is, when Falun Gong, the persecution begins in Falun Gong. It's an enormous population, maybe 2 million people at one point in detention, going down to about 1 million. It is a huge population of very, very stubborn people who hold very fast to their beliefs. And they also can't tell, they don't like to tell where they're from because they don't want their families to suffer persecution or lose their jobs or for the kids to be kicked out of school or anything like that. And so they become this huge, vulnerable population that's out there.
Now, Ethan, and, this has become a huge money-making business for the Chinese. I mean, it started off, there was some, you know, we heard, I remember first hearing prisoners on death row that their organs were harvested after they were executed. The outcry against that, they kind of moved away from that, said they were stopping that. But it looks like they have now created an industry of taking these dissidents and harvesting organs to make money with them.
That's exactly right, Tony, and that's what the investigation has concentrated on in recent years, is the size of this thing. And that, you know, really, even as people who were researching this, who were investigating it, who were talking to witnesses and so forth, we didn't expect to see this explosion of activity. But what we're looking at is something where every province in China has a couple of major hospitals, transplant hospitals, and they're going full tilt. And the construction programs are extraordinary. And the amount of organ tourists that are coming into the country, usually on the East Coast, they don't really go inland, but they're coming in, and they're going out with organs, and they're getting them in 2 weeks.
Now, you have interviewed.
Scene, and we're looking at something like $10 to $20 billion industry at this point.
$20 billion?
$20 billion, yeah. We don't know the exact figures, but the point is it's become much more profitable.
Right.
Because they can do the heart, and they can do the lungs, and they can keep those organs alive for a lot longer through a new process called ECMO. It's actually an old process, but...
Ethan, let me ask you this, because you've interviewed it for your book that you wrote. You've documented all this. You've actually interviewed witnesses. I mean, what are these people that have escaped, people that were a part of the process? What kind of, where are you getting this information? What type of witnesses?
Well, one of the people is somebody who appeared. I was here in Westminster. You know, I'm American, but I live here in London. And I gave a little talk at Westminster, and we opened it up for questions. This guy stands up. He looks sort of Chinese. Now I know he looks actually very Uyghur, but back then he looked kind of Chinese to me. And he said, I don't have a question. He said, I did this with my own hands. He was a surgeon, former surgeon, and he had been forced, he'd been told just to, you know, take a team to the execution ground take out the kidneys and the liver of a man, and the man had been shot on the left, the right side of the chest. I get my left and right mixed up. I'm sorry about that. But, you know, basically the side that doesn't have the heart. And the man was still, the heart was still beating.
Wow.
The blood was still pumping. And the man actually, when he did the first cut, the man actually, his body kind of coiled and rebelled. But he was weak, and he took out the organs and then tried to stitch the guy back up for the family.
Ethan, we're up against a break. We're out of time. I want to talk with you more. We're going to get you back on to talk more about your book, because I think this is it's shocking, but it's something the world needs to know, and this needs to be used. America needs to use this as leverage in our dealings with China.
You can find out more about Ethan, as well as the efforts of Family Research Council in the areas of religious persecution, when you visit tonyperkins.com.
From its racist eugenic roots to its selling of aborted baby parts, Planned Parenthood is an organization that not only promotes a culture of death, but makes it a reality. In a new brochure from FRC, you will find evidence that will challenge your assumptions about Planned Parenthood and equip you to be a true champion for women and the lives of unborn children. To order this brochure and to download your free digital copy, visit frc.org/Planned Parenthood.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Earlier this month, Pastor Andrew Brunson received FRC's Faith and Freedom Award at the Values Voter Summit. And now, the account of his time in a Turkish prison and his ultimate release has been documented in his new book, God's Hostage, A True Story of Persecution, Imprisonment, and Perseverance. Joining FRC President Tony Perkins to talk about it is Pastor Andrew Brunson.
Andrew, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hi, Tony.
Good to talk with you, my brother. Let's just start with the issue of prayer. How important to you was prayer when you were confined by the Turkish government?
It really kept me going. And I think of, I had so many people praying for me. It was an unprecedented prayer movement. But I know that many who are suffering for Jesus in prison are often alone. They are often believers from who've come over from a different religion, often from a Muslim background, and many of them have been rejected by their families. And it's so important to be supporting them in prayer.
I mean, prayer is real. I mean, you talked about that, about how it sustained you, and you just wanted to know that people were praying for you, that you were not alone, you were not forgotten. And you're right, it did spring forth a prayer movement as a result of the people rallying around you. And you talk a little bit about that in your book. Give our listeners a sense of your book and, you know, the story that it tells and the core of that story.
So there are two stories. There's a human side of it that was involved a lot of political intrigue, and I was held as a hostage and religious persecution. So I was held for 2 years in a Turkish prison. But behind all of that political intrigue is the second story, the deeper story, which is God's story and how God was taking what was intended to harm me by the Turkish government, what was intended to hurt me. He took it and turned it around and started this worldwide prayer movement that has just poured prayer into Turkey. So I became a magnet for prayer. And the other side of the other story was how I was really broken in prison by the conditions. But then God began to rebuild me in the second year. So it was brokenness, which often I didn't expect from the biographies I had read, you know, of strong mm-hmm. Christians who go through difficult times, and they're my heroes. But when I was in those circumstances, I found that I was weak and broken, and I turned to God in desperation, and he began to rebuild me.
Yeah, I remember you and I having that conversation actually on the plane flying back to the United States, that you said, you know, in all the biographies I read of Christians who were persecuted and you know, pressured for their faith, I never read this part. And you wanted to communicate that to other Christians, because there is that moment of discouragement and of desperation, of brokenness. And there's a sense that maybe something's wrong with you, because you never understood that other people went through that. But that's a natural part of this.
Yes, and when I thought, I don't measure up. I told my wife, Noreen, so many times, God chose the wrong man for this. And I just don't measure up to people who have gone through these things before. And over time, I came to think, well, I think God chose the right man because he wanted a weak man who could then be an encouragement to other people who are weak. And I'll say that many people who I have heard since getting out of prison, I thought it was unique to me, this weakness and brokenness. But many people who've been in prison for Jesus, obviously most of them are non-Westerners, they have said that they have an experience similar to mine, where there are
rays of light, things that God does and encourages them, but for the most part, they experience sometimes a silence of God and that feeling of abandonment. He doesn't abandon, but we sometimes feel that way, and we need to learn to stand in the dark and lean into God even when we don't feel him.
It's kind of like almost a spiritual boot camp, you know, as you've described it, where in boot camp they take and they break you down and they build you back up. And everything that we rely upon, our own strength, our own ability, all of those things are stripped away. And we're absolutely, totally dependent upon God. And that's when he then begins to build back up.
Yes, and I found that God allows his children to be tested. And when we go into the valley of testing, we can feel very alone and despondent. And I found that as I focused on him and decided to lean into him, I made a decision with my will, not with my feelings, but with my will to say, whatever you do or don't do, God, I am going to follow you. And as I did that, he met me at that point of weakness.
God's Hostage, a true story of persecution, imprisonment, and perseverance. Andrew, where can folks get a copy of your book?
I don't know, Tony. I think wherever they sell them, Amazon or I don't know.
folks, you can get it anywhere. It's a great book. Let me ask you this before we run out of time. You've been out kind of on a book tour, and you've been in a lot of secular settings about talking about your book. What's the response been like?
What I'm trying to do is simply carry the presence of Jesus. And I think especially from believers, what most touches them is to see that story of brokenness, because they're surprised by that. The story of brokenness and being rebuilt. And that's an encouragement, because a lot of people are struggling and they often think they're the only ones struggling, but they're not.
Yeah, absolutely right. That's why we need to pray for the persecuted, especially this weekend as we recognize that day. And Andrew, I'm praying for you. All right.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Tony.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.